G'day, gladdies and potties and noddies. This is, I think we've got three live late night lives to go before we wind it up for the year and go on to various forms of repetition. And, of course, it's the end of my 20th year in the chair, so I'm, you know, I get a bit meditative, a bit reflective, a bit nostalgic, and I think back about the regulars the programs had over that long period of time. When I first started, for example, our US regular was Christopher Hitchens, who went on to bigger and better things, although he's still a frequent guest on the program in one capacity or another. We had Sidney Blumenthal, who was almost uncomfortably close to the Clinton administration, made a very good contribution for quite a while. David Brooks on the other side of the political coin. David was a long-term regular on the program, talking about American politics until he became, well, a megastar on the conservative side of politics and on the speaker circuit. Now David is so lofty and so incredibly important that he won't come on the program at all. But I still love him. We used to have a great bloke called Herb Boyd. People who've been listening to the program for ages will remember her. African-American, lived in Harlem. And every week Herb and I would talk about America through the lens of Harlem politics. Locally, of course, we had Fran Kelly, because before she became a very famous RN person, who could forget the contributions of Margot Kingston over quite a long time, and the more moderate, sober assessments of Jeff Kitney. From Malaysia, Eden Koo. From Hong Kong, Willie Lam. And Satchit Dasis, who's sitting opposite me at the moment. About 15 years ago, we came into contact for the first time with B. Campbell. And it's 10 years now since our dear friend Bruce Shapiro joined the team. So what I thought we'd do on this tonight's program is get most of the current number of team members together to have a retrospective, to look back on the year. So we have Bruce Shapiro on the blower from the States. We've got B. Campbell, OBE, in the BBC studio in London, locked out of our Canberra studio through misadventure, because no one can find the keys, is Christian Kerr, one of our Canberra correspondents, and he's on the blower. I'm not joking about him getting locked out. This is the nature of live wireless. And as I said, sitting opposite me is Das, financial analyst extraordinaire, and it's good to have you all with me. What I want to do is ask for each of you to soliloquise, to look back on the year as you see it, as you experience it. Pull out what you think are its significant themes and subtext. And I'll start with you, Mr. Shapiro, way over the other side of the world in New York.
Gosh, well, first of all, 10 years. That in and of itself is a remarkable thing. There's more gray hair on my head. Anyway, look, this, from where I sit, this has been an extraordinary once-in-a-generation kind of year of change, not only in the U.S., but worldwide. And it's impossible, I think, to separate the local from the global this year. There's just been so much continual bouncing around the globe of issues and ideas, but you know, you kind of have to go to 1968 or something like that to think about a year in which so much seemed to change. Think about the span from the Arab Spring upheaval in the Middle East, this central part of the world, to Occupy Wall Street and the European crisis in the middle of that. All of them related to one another. To me, the common themes, and of course, it's always dangerous to try to make things tie up too neatly, but I do think there are some common themes here. You know, you have outpourings of democratic aspiration, first of all, which Occupy certainly represents here the encampments that have sprung up all over the country. I spent the weekend driving around New England, and in every town I stopped in, virtually, there was an Occupy encampment. It was remarkable. That certainly the Arab Spring representing the exhaustion of authoritarian governance in the Mideast, a part of the world that that cynical analysts often said could never really see democratic aspiration, where people love their strongmen. Well, you know, Tunisia, Egypt, and the ongoing crisis in Syria disprove that thesis about Arab political psychology, and I think that's very important. In Europe, the protests against austerity and budget cutting, I think the common themes are a sense that a sense that Reaganism, the political ideology that became known as Reaganism, which has colored my entire adult life for all practical purposes, 30 years, has finally come to an end. That we've had leadership failure after leadership failure around the world in the face of an economic crisis and in the face of democratic aspiration, because the terms of debate don't work anymore. Even as shrewd a political leader as Barack Obama, whose election did so much to spur the sense of the possibility of change onward, and whose speech in the Mideast, I think, helped spark the Arab Spring, even Obama has, we sense, been trapped by the terms of debate proposed over the last 30 years, that Wall Street rules, that freeing up finance and capital for investment in private enterprise is the sole and main purpose of government, that you know you can't easily shut down wars, that all this sort of thing. And I think what we're seeing this year is a huge public assertion in the U.S. anyway, and I think elsewhere, that this is not enough, that there has to be a different kind of social contract.
Take a deep breath, Bruce. Having encouraged you to soliloquize, I've now got to interrupt because the quality, the sonic quality, is problematic. And if you cease and desist, we shall make contact with you again to improve the sound. And at the moment, I wish to talk to you, Das, because it's a mixed bag, isn't it? Here we've got a world where, on the one hand, there are signs of political optimism and courage, people out in the streets risking their lives, but with the belief that the world can be better. But in most other parts, there's an overwhelming sense of depression, of sadness, It's a very different picture, and certainly economically, almost everywhere, it's not a time of optimism.
Well, I think this year, for me anyway, is about the end of certain things, not beginnings. It's the end of growth, and it's the end of trust. And the best way to look at it is where Europe fits into all of this, as Bruce was saying. To me, the best way to think about Europe is you can think of it at two levels. One, it's the greatest comedy duo in history, which is Nicolas Sarkozy and Angela Merkel, or the greatest magicians, the same two people, because now Europe is coming off the rails, and I don't believe they'll fix the problem this weekend. It'll just go on. And it is, to my mind, what Russell McKibben here called the Great Sovereign Express coming off the track, because we never fixed the problems of 2008. They became, from the global financial crisis to the global sovereign crisis, because the sovereigns tried to bail out everybody.
So this is another bad year, only worse.
It is, that's right. And what that's done in a rather perverse way is now we have a very interesting problem. The first is, I think people have realized that economic growth as the engine for everything, solving poverty, solving the problem of developing countries, has pretty much run its course. The second issue there is that we've discovered that all the political leaders, the policymakers, the tools they have, they basically don't have the tools to deal with this anymore. And so there's a huge negative there. And in the process of trying to deal with the problem, I think we are starting to see what I call the end of trust. We're destroying money by printing it everywhere around the world. And so as a store of value or as a mechanism of exchange, it's destroyed. The second issue is we used to have government bonds as a very safe store of value. In fact, Jim Grant called it very nicely. They used to be risk-free returns. Now they're return-free risks. And we also have complete distrust in banking. I mean, Jimmy Stewart from It's a Wonderful Life wouldn't recognize a bank now. And then you have essentially the thing we were talking about, the policymakers and so forth, and what Bruce is talking about with Occupy Wall Street. It is this sense of failure, of everything that we've tried for has failed to some varying degrees. Now, the question is, out of this end, can we have a new beginning?
Well, that's what let me put that to you. It's a time when almost universally there's a sense of despair and despondency that there is going to be a financial apocalypse. In fact, for many people, it has already occurred.
Yes, it is.
They're living it. Often, times like this, you can interpret in two ways. You can say we are hearing the moans of the dying, or we are hearing the cries of the newborn. Will we bounce back from this? Is something wonderful going to happen as a consequence of the crisis?
I hope so, because I think we have to get away from a world which is driven by growth. We have to live within certain limits. We have to look at equality of distribution in different ways. But at the same time, while I hope for those things, I'm not optimistic that everybody will accept that, because everybody is now looking for the line of least resistance. We have countries circling the wagons. We have people trying to really beggar your neighbors in different ways to actually get out of this problem. And I hope that we all get together and try to solve the problem. But whether we will be capable of doing that, I don't know.
Let's go to B. Campbell. B, the year for you. Give us your feelings about it, the dynamics of the year, what's going on and what's going to happen as a consequence.
It feels like a year in which my country is taking itself by surprise and is learning something about itself that it didn't quite know, doing things that it never thought it would do. Let's look at the Occupy the London Stock Exchange encampment at St. Paul's. And this resonates with everything that my two friends have already been talking about. You know, this was supposed to be a little encampment somewhere around the London Stock Exchange, which is situated not very far from St. Paul's Cathedral and absolutely adjacent to one of the poorest boroughs in all of these islands. So you've got this little island in the middle of London, the city, and that was the target of the Occupy movement. They couldn't get within inches of it, so what they did was to set up camp at St. Paul's Cathedral, as you all know. And that produced the most surprising crisis. Who would have thought that this small but, some might say very beautiful, some might say kind of raggedy, little crew in their quite flimsy little camp, little tents on the doorstep of St. Paul's would have so shaken the Church of England. What we didn't entirely know at the time was that the Church of England itself, and in particular the St. Paul's Institute, which are the people who do the thinking at St. Paul's Cathedral, were themselves trying to sort out what the relationship between the church and the city should be. Okay, so the encampment starts and the church makes the fatal mistake of lining up with the City of London Corporation, the people who have brought us, or the square mile that has brought us to our knees, the world to the brink, and both of them share legal actions to evict the little camp from the steps of the church. This provoked the most humongous cleavage within the church, between the church and the city. There was then evidence of a delayed report, which had been a St. Paul's Institute inquiry into value and values. What should the church's disposition be to the capital being circulated on its doorstep? So the marvellous thing was that it then did the worst thing it could possibly have done, which is to shut its doors. So the great doors of this lovely Wren Cathedral, visited by thousands every day, were shut. horror of horrors. First of all, it revealed that the St. Paul's Cathedral, well, what was it? Was it a church? Was it a museum? Was it a heritage industry? People were horrified by the closure, even people who might not have been madly sympathetic to the occupation. But what it then did was to get people down to St. Paul's to see what this horror was, this little encampment. And it turned out what they witnessed was something really rather sweet and hugely clever. Their own kitchens, their own very, very savvy media department in a tent with little laptops powered by solar energy and no doubt tuned up and zuzzed up when people went home for a shower. And most marvellously, a tent called Tea and Empathy. Even more marvellously, Tent City University, which hosted what became a kind of dense parade of seminars where people of all manner of scholarships would come and talk, surrounded by, and this is, let me tell you, a typical day. You go along there, you visit the place, and you'll find yourself in conversations with men in suits and striped shirts, ladies who've come in from the suburbs because they just want to see what it's like, having conversations about capitalism. And for weeks, this went on without a single politician, with the exception of the Green MP, Caroline Lucas, not one single politician getting on the number 15 bus from the House of Commons down to St. Paul's to see what it was all about. So this little, modest, very benign, very peaceful encampment produced the most enormous fissure within the established church and in its relationship between the Church of England and the City of London, and became a kind of hub for conversation and interest, till finally a couple of politicians, the leader of the Labour Party, Ed Miliband, who was hugely embarrassed by the occupation, finally said, oh, well, yes, they've got a point. Yes, they've got a point.
Before I bring Christian Kerr in, I want to remind you that over the last 15 years since we've been nattering together, the theme of the monarchy has been, well, not central, but important, important. What sort of a year has it been for the royal family? An annus horribilis or one of modest achievement?
Oh, there will be smiles all the way to the Royal Bank, I should think. There's nothing like a death, a marriage, and soon, I assume, to be a baby. Certainly next year, an anniversary. There's nothing like that to restore the fortunes of the monarchs. Because, you see, they've all taken the advice, sometimes more or less seriously, of George III, who said, be seen, above all, be seen. Now, given that the impact of the monarchy in Britain is subject to massive criticism whenever Prince Charles gets his pen out, because he's known to be someone who somewhat, shall we say, expands the mandate of the monarchy to interfere in things, and people don't like that. But when it's a matter of being seen and having a party and wearing a frock, those are good times for the monarchy. So this year has been a good year for the monarchy, what with the royal wedding, and next year will be another, I think it's the Jubilee. There will no doubt be an awful lot more of being seen.
So we counted the winds out a bit prematurely. This is Late Night Live on ABC Radio National. We're here to Australia and the World Wide Web, and I'm surrounded by the program's closest friends, our regulars, Bruce Shapiro, B. Campbell, Suchita Das, and in Canberra, Christian Kerr. Christian, the year that, as you see it, as you experienced it, in the national capital.
Well, I'm going to end up talking about trust and the political class too. And the thing which has startled me the most this year has been an Australia which is still relatively immune from some of these international trials and tribulations, has just to be seen the way our political parties have rejected democratisation. It's pretty remarkable. You've seen both the major parties have major proposals put up to open themselves up, to reinvigorate themselves, to try and become more meaningful organisations, and both of the major parties have found this incredibly hard. I mean, it's been amazing to see the cast who's actually been putting up these proposals. On the Liberal side, you've got someone as wily as Peter Reeve. You look at Labour, you've got Steve Brax, a man of the decency of John Faulkner, and then a character with, I think, the intellectual rigour and a vigour of Bob Carr, with their proposals for the Labour Party. These concepts of greater opportunities for participation for ordinary members, greater power for ordinary members, more opportunities for debate even, these have all seemed to have threatened the power structures of our political parties. At a time when our politics is effectively in a deadlock, when our last federal election produced a hung parliament, when there's not any particular level of enthusiasm for either of our leaders, for our prime minister, for our opposition leader, when the parties themselves seem to have actually recognised that they need to change because they're no longer the mass-based movements they were, to find our political parties too terrified to actually change themselves, to actually fail this challenge of change that they have set for themselves, that has been the most marked thing out of politics for me this year.
Bruce Shapiro, 20 years ago when I first sat in this chair, the United States of America, it seemed to me, was about as inward-looking as a nation could be. I remember at the time about 90% of its media inputs focused internally. It was a country that was blissfully ignorant of the outside world, unless, as John Stewart might put it, it was bombing it. Has America, in the current crises, been forced to realise it's a part of a wider world?
Well, I think awareness kind of moves in and out. At times of crisis, the U.S. tends to become more inward-looking rather than more expansive. And yet, it's been impossible to remain disconnected and unaffected. We certainly, most Americans now know more or less where Iraq and Afghanistan are on the map. What's been interesting this year has been to watch those wars diminish in public consciousness as troops have drawn down, as President Obama has worked toward low-level engagement as opposed to high-level constant conflict. We still have large numbers of soldiers coming home deeply traumatized. We still have huge economic problems as a result of those wars. But war is no longer dominating American consciousness for the first time since 2001, and that's an enormous change. The country was deeply affected by the Arab Spring, and you can in fact need to draw a direct line from the Arab Spring, which echoed so much with the language of nonviolence and civil rights movement in the U.S., the Gandhian independence movement in India. All of that had a huge effect on the American public, and a huge effect in particular, I think, on the American activist class, if you will, on students and labor unions and others. I think that is why the Occupy movement took off, because we'd had this recent example of power and authority in the terms of debate being challenged from the street, challenged through the power of nonviolence. What an extraordinary thing. So in that sense, the world did penetrate American, not only consciousness, but American politics, American political practice this year in a new way. That said, I think most Americans remain pretty insulated from events in Europe and Asia, the exception being that as the European economy teeters on the brink of crisis, as first Ireland and then Greece default, you do get American markets roiled. And because so much of our sort of national consciousness over the last generation has gone into taking care of your privatized retirement fund and otherwise having reasons to care about the state of the market. We are, if you go to your corner coffee shop, you will find interesting conversations going on about Merkel and Sarkozy. So there's a little more awareness. It's still, if you listen to the political debates, the campaigning this year for Congress, or the preparation for the presidential campaign, it's still pretty much an inward-turned country. But the ripples of the world just wash over us in an inevitable way, and we have been profoundly changed this year by what's going on elsewhere.
Das, let's imagine this little wireless program was in India, and we're sitting having a discussion about 2011 in Delhi or Mumbai. What would we think of the year? What would we see of the year from that vantage point?
Well, I think I would do India and Beijing at the same time, because I think the view from that, particularly towards the developed world, has changed very significantly. Because I think until probably about 2006, 2007, there was a feeling that the developed world had worked out their business models, their economic models, their financial models, and they had something to teach India and Beijing. But now there is a deep sense that the models there don't work. And what is really of concern to these people in different ways is the fact that the failures of the developed world will affect them. For instance, in India, I hear now that the colonials have basically damaged us in so many different ways during the colonial period. Then now when we are growing, they manage to do things which essentially damage us. And in Beijing, there is actually a fascinating sense of mistrust, because they have taken $3.2 trillion of our sweat and hard work, which we've invested in their government bonds, which are now losing value literally by billions every minute. And these people are actually deliberately doing that to us. And that is very, very deep. And then Christine Lagarde comes on behalf of the IMF to Beijing to ask us to put money to help save Europe. And the irony of asking a country where the average person, average income is 4,000, helping a country with an average income of 30,000 is completely lost on Christine Lagarde, who says that they won't accept any conditional aid, like, you know, give us Taiwan, give us Tibet, and all of these types of things. And it's an extraordinary shift in that. And I think that deep sense of distrust is actually now permeating global relationships. And I think that's a very significant change, not so much this year, but over the last two or three years.
Christian, as we are painfully aware, Barack Obama visited Australia with news that America wanted to engage more with Asia. Hillary Clinton, of course, has recently been in Burma checking the temperature. And the thing that you and I discussed at the time was the curious lack of intensity of political response to the Obama-Gillard proposition. Is Australia looking beyond its shores to any great extent in Canberra?
I don't think we are at the moment. I think one of the issues is that we've had a Prime Minister who, unlike so many other Prime Ministers, has had a really solid domestic focus. I mean, Julia Gillard very much worked away through our political consciousness in opposition by concentrating on probably the two most bread and butter domestic issues, education and health. When she came into government as Deputy Prime Minister, of course, she was Education Minister. I've always thought that there was a deliberate choice of education, too, for Julia Gillard. It was a political way of neutralising the fact that she didn't have children, that she didn't have a family, which I think is something that still a sizable proportion of voters would expect to see in a politician. But she's had a solid domestic focus, and really the way Australia's been keeping on its merry little way since the global financial crisis has reinforced this. I mean, one of the things that's been astounding again this year to see in Australia is the way we've just totally ignored until it was unable to be ignored. The state of the United States economy, the deteriorating condition of Europe. I mean, it really only seems to have dawned upon us in the last few weeks, I think, just that there are these issues going on. I think we don't know the severity yet. Even last weekend's Labour Party conference, against the background of Europe, the big debate was same-sex marriage. There's this strange disconnect in Australian politics at the moment. It might be because we are in such a different situation with a minority government, but it is just, it's not wholesome, this lack of disconnect from the world.
Australia was relatively unscathed by the global financial crisis, whereas, of course, your country was very scathed. Let's go back to the hundreds of thousands of teachers, nurses, border guards protesting over pension reforms, with Britain's first mass strike for more than 30 years. Cameron, of course, dismisses it as something of a damp squib. Was it?
It wasn't. It was another surprise, actually. Partly because the language of the trade union movement before the actual strike on the day of November the 30th was somewhat familiar. I have to say it's always a kind of constipated and rather formal language. Hearing trade unionists on the telly is often like hearing police officers, because what they want to say is often translated into a kind of code which increasingly doesn't really belong to the vernacular that we all use. However, something very interesting happened. Number one, it was a successful strike. It was absolutely massive. Number two, the language of the government and many of its advocates was, look, we're all in this mess together. Here you've got these people who've got gold-plated pensions. These are the haves of British society. We who don't have public sector pensions, we who are not janitors and school dinner ladies, we've got the crappy pensions, or indeed no pensions, of the private sector. And then something remarkable happened that really disrupted this new vocabulary of the haves and the have-nots. People looked at the strikers and they saw themselves. People saw nice people like themselves. Furthermore, the trade union movement's advocates on the day finally began to tell us something about the people who were on strike. 65% of the people involved in the public sector are low-paid and medium-level-paid women. Their average pension is £3,000. Excuse me, how do you call that a have? So they discovered something about their own people that turned out to be rather important. People began to see that these alleged haves were A, only really not very have actually, but like themselves, and furthermore were not very well public sector workers upon whom everybody depends. So even the language of the organisers had to change in order to well and authentically represent the strikers.
Sorry, forgive me. A cough button. Das, you talk about trust. Every time we have a conversation, the notion of trust comes up, and we absolutely agree with you that it's been badly damaged almost in every direction. How does society's plural, how do all the conflicted people go about rebuilding trust?
Well, I can only comment about the areas where I have some knowledge of. But I think you have to, firstly, diagnose the problem properly, be honest about it to people. And I think you have to understand that the process of getting out of it is difficult. But there has to be a proper discussion about the way to do it, the risks of doing it, and most importantly, how you share it. And particularly share the pain. Mm. And I think that is in, say, Greece, a huge problem. That is also actually, interestingly, a problem in Britain. That's a problem in France, in Italy.
Is it a problem here? Let's ask Christian. Is this an issue for Australians?
Yes, I think it is an issue for Australians. I mean, I think the most fundamental issue that we're going to see in the next few months, at the beginning of the year, probably between the start of the political year and Easter, is, do we trust our Prime Minister? She's closing the year with her position improved, with her party's position, though still pretty perilous in the polls. And the best reason for that that we have at the moment is that she said before the election that there will be no carbon tax under the government I lead. And yet, she was immediately pleading circumstances after that election, and we now have that carbon tax. We have the legislation for that. It seems that our politics at the moment is dominated effectively by a broken promise, and that the Prime Minister still will really stand and fall on how we react to that broken promise.
Bruce Shapiro, trust is a major problem in the US politics.
Well, indeed, and you know, we saw that dominate last year on the right with the Tea Party, which took on the idea of betrayal of trust in the conservative Republican world. We are seeing it play out with Occupy, which plays this very delicate role of criticizing the Obama administration for being too close to Wall Street and yet not wanting to push too far. And there's big arguments within the Occupy movement about how far to go in protesting against Obama's policies, but there is a sense that trust is broken, that government represents lobbyists and industry, that it ceased to become representative, and that has been a theme. That kind of, you know, that's been a theme in American politics on and off for generations, but it's certainly a major issue now. And the question going into this crucial election year will be whether that sense of betrayal of trust remains articulated as it has been in recent months through the sort of aspirational politics, the language that draws a circle around most of the population and says, we are the 99%. It was really striking during the Atlanta Occupy protests to have the police union say to protesters in a very civil way, remember that we are part of the 99% too. So there is this sense that the 99% has been betrayed but can change things if we work together. That's put unions into relationships with protesters and so on. Will that maintain, or is it going to turn into a cynical, debunking, rejectionist sense of betrayal, which would favor probably conservative Republican candidates who are trying to ride a wave of voter suspicion against leaders and government of all kinds, and then use that as an excuse for even more deregulation, even more conservative economic policies.
I've gathered around me tonight, dear listener, the people that I trust to make intelligent comments on every aspect of national and international politics, and I'm now going to play a grab from someone I wish was a regular, but we can never quite get him on enough. And it takes us back to the whole issue of the US and China, which has to be one of the great themes of 2011 and of 2012. This is Paul Keating.
So the point is that a wise United States will try and set the world up, having lost 20 years at the end of the Cold War, wasted 20 years in not divining a much more representative world structure, which included the great states like China and India and Russia. But now, late in the piece, as President Obama is returning to liberal internationalism, not a minute too soon, they have a chance of rebuilding a structure where they sit at the top table. But that must be a representative structure.
That was Paul on this program last week. B, do the British obsess about China the way Australia and the United States do?
No, the British don't obsess about China. Bear in mind, the British are stuck in an island They don't even obsess about Europe. They don't obsess about anywhere. They're only obsessed really about themselves.
forgive me, but I do want to talk about something which I know excludes most of your fellow country persons, but he makes a very powerful point, doesn't he, Mr. Keating?
He does, and I think the point is that I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about the geopolitical ambitions of China. I think the major thing is that China wants to be recognized as a world power. It wants to have effectively a seat, as Mr. Keating said, at the table. It wants to have an equal relationship with everybody. And the point is that it wants to be appreciated for the fact that it's lent all this frigging money to everybody else and they want it to be paid back.
Yeah.
And they want to have access to markets. And they also want, frankly, the recognition that they face a lot of challenges, which are very difficult for them to overcome on their own.
There's not an overt sense of imperialism in the current Chinese psyche.
Well, I only deal with certain people, and Mr. Keating deals with people at a different level, but I see no imperialism. In fact, I see a great degree of insecurity and fear that they've actually got things wrong, and they want to correct them. And I think that's the key, and you have to work with them.
Sorry, they've got things wrong.
Well, I think they understand their economic model, which has been very reliant on exports and on heavy investment, creating these ghost cities and ghost malls. They want to change, and they want to find a way to do it. But as long as somebody threatens the Chinese Communist Party and basically threatens them with oblivion, and to some extent the democracy movements in North Africa and so forth, they find extraordinarily threatening, because they see how fragile their hold on power could be. So there's all these conflicting things going on. And the more pressure you put, and the US Congress pressure on Chinese in terms of trade and the currency, and this constant rabbiting on about it, doesn't help. It doesn't help.
Bruce Shapiro, the advice that Paul Keating was just giving the United States, does it make sense to you?
It does. It certainly... I think there's a bit of an internal war going on in the Obama administration over exactly that terrain. Just how far in an election year, or indeed in any year, can and should the Obama administration go toward liberal foreign policy, toward a kind of an almost Wilsonian kind of foreign policy that imagines the U.S. At times taking a leadership role, as it seems to have done in Burma, in pushing forward responsible change in human rights, at times leading from behind, as was the policy in Libya, a very shrewdly calculated military intervention, whatever its wisdom. But the stumbling block in all of this, I think, is in fact China and the global economy. What does foreign policy really mean at a time when the world is being driven by huge shifts of investment and wealth to parts of the world with the lowest environmental or legal or regulatory standards? That's been going on for a generation.
I thought you've just described the United States as a country with the lowest standards of environmental regulation.
Well, indeed, even within the U.S., what's been roiling this country for years now is the relocation of industry to places like from places in the Northeast to places like Texas, or from the Midwest to places like Alabama. But even that shift has for some years been outstripped by the shift of jobs to China. And the trade imbalance and all of this puts enormous pressure on the foreign policy folks to figure out how to advance human rights, how to articulate an American role in the world that's very different from what President Bush and Vice President Cheney articulated, that their sense of an America being the unilateral power. But where does foreign policy and economy come together? I think the Obama administration is arguing very much about that as it watches Europe nervously, as it watches China nervously. It was interesting to hear Das talk about fear. because I think there's enormous fear at the upper levels of this administration and this government as well about all the uncertainty around the world.
Beatrix Campbell, OBE. Now, you have just established that the British are not obsessing about China, but they've always obsessed about the relationship with the United States of America. And in our years together, we often talked about the unseemly intimacy that Tony Blair, the Beau Blair, as you always called him, sought with George W. Bush. What's the current state of play with the Brits in terms of Washington?
Well, bizarrely, it's a less intimate relationship. Here we had a very conservative American president, beloved by a Labour prime minister, whose mantra, well, he was given the mantra, hug 'em close. The relationship between the coalition government and Washington is less passionate. And of course, they're managing some very delicate manoeuvres, because we're emerging out of a period where the so-called humane neo-imperial war making as a strategy for sorting out international relations has really come unstuck. And I think in Britain, surprisingly, the relationship between the British Foreign Secretary and France and Germany and Europe in general, in response to the Arab Spring and in response to the ferocious response, the ferocious attacks on the people by some of these states, which have been, of course, bankrolled by Britain and America for decades. All of that is being delicately managed in Britain. And I think that although the relationship to the United States will be close and they won't move without each other, something unsettling is happening, partly, of course, because British diplomacy and United States diplomacy backed the wrong people. It was backing very authoritarian states in the Middle East and, indeed, of course, Israel. And the Arab Spring exposed that. It also exposed its own ferocious response to peaceful demonstrations in Britain itself. So something is being kind of knocked and budged around really quite well-established traditions of international diplomacy and domestic behaviour.
Back to Christian Kerr, who's been locked out of the studios in Canberra. Christian, over the last 12 months, you and I have discussed the abrasive, aggressive, almost ludicrously aggressive sort of contretemps between Abbott and Gillard. But on this question of our relationship with the United States, there's effectively harmony and bliss. Talk to that.
It's a given in Australian politics, I think, the American alliance. It's one of those strange things when we have these occasional visits by the president. You have such uniformity of views. I mean,
it wasn't a given when Bush was here. You know, Bush administration deeply polarised Australian opinion.
That's the fascinating contrast. I mean, the clearest contrast to me is that you had the Greens getting thrown out of the House of Representatives during the joint sitting George W. Bush addressed, and this time you had the Greens almost fawning over.
Well, they joined Mark Latham's famous conga line, hadn't they?
Well, they did, and they were enthusiastic. Their media releases ahead of his visit were virtually press ganging him into their ranks. The Greens were so keen. It's fascinating, too, this comparison between America and China. I mean, I think the great stumbling block to that world that Paul Keating is talking about is just our perceptions of China. We've had with the manufacturing sector crises, the job losses in BlueScope and OneSteel, we had Paul Howes very much came out with rhetoric which was similar to so many American politicians about China's currency. That, I think, is an arcane debate, just goes over the heads of too many Australians. But I think there's this terrible perception about China in Australia. China, I think, to so many Australians, represent the most exploitative aspects of capitalism, and in a uniquely grotesque manner, it's still managing to combine them with some of the most oppressive elements of socialism. And then there are things we barely even hear about, like some of China's conduct in Africa, which smacks of the days of the Belgian Congo. I mean, all of this is just the sort of thing that keeps reinforcing the American alliance.
Okay, a quick whip around as we wind up our review of 2011, and I want to project us into 2012. In essence, Das, is it going to be a year of living very dangerously, a year of disaster, or is there a hint of hope?
Just before I say that, one of the most amusing things of the year was at the Occupy Wall Street protest. There was this woman who had this megaphone, and she was screaming at the loudest possible voice, "We don't have a voice! We don't have a voice!" And I certainly think that movement has got a voice now. But coming back, I think it's going to be a year of very dangerous, and I think things are very finely balanced. And I think it's going to be very difficult to see much emerging for a while, because we've got decisions to make.
B, what do you think?
I think
in 30 seconds or less.
Oh, the theatre of dissent will proliferate. Politicians will be scared and cling to a paradigm that's clearly just cracking up. And it's in the fissures of that crack up, so to say, that new political forms will begin to emerge. That absolutely has to happen.
Christian?
I think 2012 will be the year in which we finally cannot ignore the international economy.
And Bruce Shapiro?
The language of American politics is going to undergo a huge change over this year, and the only question is whether leadership will catch up with that change in language and change in understanding, or if the gulf will grow.
Ladies and gentlemen, I thank you very much. Most of our regulars together, Bruce Shapiro, B. Campbell, Christian Kerr, Satyajit Das. Thank you very much for your contributions. I am very fond of all of you, and you're a great help. On our next, Richard Boll, who first brought Shell's operations in Nigeria to world attention, and he's going to be joined by Sonia Purnell, who's just published her biography of London's mayor, Boris Johnson. Stick around now on ABC Radio National for the news. And with a little bit of luck, we'll see you later.